friends, and welcome to Patient Innovations. I'm Mary McCarthy.
And I'm Rashmi Kandwal.
And we are your co-hosts for Patient Innovations from Healthcare MN, which is a large nonprofit networking group in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. Each month, we explore patient indications and innovation for diagnosing and treating patients. We start with a discussion with the patient, then talk with researchers, funders, and startup founders to learn about the latest innovations coming to market. Today, we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, and our guests are Canada Yazbek, Susan Perriott, CEO of the Alzheimer's Association of Minnesota and North Dakota, and Dr. Joe Gogler from the University of Minnesota. Many of us have been affected by Alzheimer's disease, whether it's a family member, a friend, or even ourselves. And so I'm really excited to present this show for you today.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for the introduction. And with that, let me first dig into some stats on Alzheimer's, providing a sobering perspective on the challenges that we face. Dementia encompasses a range of diseases and injuries affecting the brain, with Alzheimer's disease being the most prevalent form, contributing to 60 to 70% of cases. According to the Alzheimer's Association and the World Health Organization, nearly 7 million Americans and 55 million individuals worldwide are living with Alzheimer's today, with almost two-thirds of them being women. In the U.S., this number is projected to almost double to nearly 13 million by 2050. This increase will also impact health and long-term care costs, estimated to reach around $360 billion in 2024 and nearly $1 trillion in 2050. Despite these staggering figures, 60% of healthcare workers believe that the U.S. healthcare system is not effectively assisting patients and their families in navigating dementia care.
It's quite a high number.
That is, yeah. Every time we do an episode and the numbers that come up, I'm just always surprised. Yeah. So with that in perspective, let me welcome Canada Yazbek, our first guest. Canada started noticing memory issues just before her 40th birthday when she suddenly could not process how to wash her hair, something she had done thousands of times before. A year later, she was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, which means she's more likely to develop dementia. She has experienced Alzheimer's up close with others, having lost six close family members to dementia, including her grandmother. Now 49, Canada is a fierce advocate of Alzheimer's and dementia funding, treatment access and research, meeting with legislators, and sharing her story. And that's what we are doing with her today here. As a frequent presenter and spokesperson, she raises awareness, inspires others, and strives to break the stigma around speaking out about dementia. Canada recently received a National 2024 Advocate of the Year Award in Washington, D.C. from the Alzheimer's Impact Movement. So, yay. Here. And she currently lives in Ramsey, Minnesota with her family, previously worked as a realtor for Keller Williams. Canada is hopeful that the new FDA-approved treatment will give her more time with her family and that advances in research will one day lead to a cure for Alzheimer's and dementia. Mary, do you want to take the first question?
Yeah. Welcome to Patient Innovations Canada.
Thank you so much
for sharing your story with us. And great congratulations again on winning the national award. So amazing. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and your life leading up to your diagnosis back when you were about 40.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I would say my life was pretty normal. I live with my care partner, and we have three young children at home. We have twin 10-year-olds and a 12-year-old. And I have been involved with the Alzheimer's Association for 21 years, but originally I would be advocating or talking about my grandmother, who lived with Alzheimer's, early onset Alzheimer's, for 20 years before she passed away in 2007, excuse me. I was 12, so I became a caregiver at 12, and just have continued to volunteer with the association, but my story changed a little bit around my 40th birthday.
So we all forget things. I do all the time. Several times last week, I couldn't remember people's last name. But like, I don't say like I have Alzheimer's. Like, what prompted you to question your memory and ask your doctor about it? And how did they respond?
Yeah, interestingly, and that's so true, because a lot of things can affect our memory day to day that are not dementia or Alzheimer's. You know, memory, just forgetting things. And those can be from lack of sleep, stress, normal everyday things. For me, it was more a cognitive issue. I was taking a shower and I couldn't process my hair, or couldn't process washing my hair, excuse me. And it was like I knew that I needed to wash my hair. I knew my hair was going to be clean, but I just couldn't process it. And that shows up in my daily life. Even today, I was just walking, and I was walking out of a room, and I went to pull the door shut, and I couldn't walk. And it's my brain was like, I was like, what are we doing? Move. And my body just doesn't follow along. Sometimes it's like there's a disconnect almost. So for me, it was more than memory issues. And I think that's always kind of the tricky part, is it shows up in different ways other than just memory. I mean, my memory is not good, but it's other things, I think, that I see it more day to day than just memory. I'm a note taker inherently, like that's always how I've been. So that to me isn't as disturbing or isn't as big of an issue as just me, more the cognitive stuff, processing stuff. We have a container of rice in our fridge right now that is uncooked and does not belong in the fridge. But I put it there when grocery shopping about a month ago, and my family just, in hopes to not, they just a lot of times won't say anything, or they'll just fix it. And apparently nobody's mm-hmm. fixed it, because I noticed the rice is still in the fridge. But so I'll put weird things away in weird spots. And in my brain, it probably made sense at the time. So
you're going along, raising children. Mm-hmm. You notice something isn't right here, and you talk to your doctor about it. Can you tell us a little bit about how they diagnosed it and the any subsequent diagnoses from then on?
Yeah. I did right away. I knew. And I think I felt like I always kind of knew. On my mother's side, I have one great aunt that has not gotten it. She lived in Norway all of her adult life up until she was about 65. Now she lives stateside, but she did not get it. And so I just kind of always knew, I think. And so I was seen, and my original doctor was very dismissive. He said, you're 40. I doubt there's anything wrong. It's probably nothing. You're just hypersensitive to it. And I did the testing and came back, and he was like, we have a problem. And then my subsequent testing, they kind of baselined me. So they did a PET scan at that time, and then I did a 4-hour neuropsych. It's a 3 to 4 hour neuropsych test. And then the following year, right around my 41st birthday, I was seen again. And they kind of compare how you do from the previous year. And that's when I officially got my diagnosis, was around my 41st birthday. So, mm-hmm.
So even though you were genetically predisposed, there was still a chance that the doctor would say nothing to worry about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that for me was very disheartening, because yeah. My grandma, I still remember. I remember being there, actually. And my mom's or my grandmother's doctor said, if you can find your way home from the grocery store, you have nothing to worry about. Now, granted, that was 30-some years ago. But it was only 10 years ago that I was going through the same thing. And I was like, this is how far we've come in all this time. That's not great. I'd like to see us farther ahead. I'd like us to take people's concerns more seriously and not quite so dismissive, no matter who it is. Because had I not had this family history, I might have gone home and been like, well, my doctor said that this is stupid. And even though he said there was not stupid, but very dismissive about it, that very well could have been the end of it, and I maybe wouldn't have gone back year after year, the following year. So that's hard. I would like us to get further along in care from
can
that
you,
perspective.
Can you just for a minute go back to when you said the doctor was dismissive, but you ended up taking the tests? Mm-hmm. So how did that happen? Is it did you still ask him, or is this test that you can stand alone take yourself?
No, I needed to kind of push him.
Okay, so pushing him.
Yep.
Okay.
And I just was I was being my own best advocate at that point, okay. Which I think is we have to do sometimes. I see people in the world, you know, with doing the stuff I do with the association, I see people much younger than myself. We have a friend who, his mom is an advocate, and he just passed away, and I believe he was in his early to mid-40s and had been living with it for some time. And they do have the gene mutation in their family. But we don't, in that world, we don't have a lot of, there's only a couple of hereditary markers at this point, so I'm also hopeful that in the future we can figure out what that looks like more too.
For those listeners who are not familiar with that initial test that led to your diagnosis, what is the actual test?
Mm-hmm. The neuropsych test is it's a bunch of tests, and they use it for a lot of diagnosing a lot of different things. I think one of my kids did it for ADHD, so it's very similar. It's a lot of like, I remember they tell you a story about Bob the farmer, and his name's not Bob, by the way, but Bob the farmer who has, you know, all these animals, and then they want you to repeat back like the key points of the story, and then an hour later they ask you about Bob the farmer, and I remember going, like, because it's so many, it's a lot of puzzles, a lot of games. There's some stuff on the computer. So just kind of different things like that. I think people are a lot of times familiar with setting the clock for the right time. But it's like the next level to that. So a lot of puzzle stuff with some cubes and things like that. So
Canada, what advice do you have for people who have been recently diagnosed, given your experiences?
I think part of the piece that, and I think it's gotten better, but part of the piece I think that we miss a lot of times is people will get this diagnosis and sometimes they won't. There's times where doctors will diagnose these diseases and not even tell the patient that they have them. But I think that one thing that's so important is the Alzheimer's Association, to be honest. We didn't have them the first 10 years of my family's journey through this. And my great-grandma disappeared for 5 days, and we couldn't find her. And this was prior to social media, things like that. So, you know, my mom was on the news. We were having flyers printed to go out on Domino's boxes. But just a lot of times where we could have used the association. And this disease is so isolating. And so just to have people around you, who know what you're going through and what that looks like makes a big difference. I wish that, you know, my grandma saw 5 neurologists, her primary doctor, infectious disease doctor, a couple other doctors. And like at the end of the day, nobody ever said, here's these folks, like call them. And yeah. I know that back when my grandma was diagnosed, the Alzheimer's Association was different than it is today. But still, we could have grown right alongside them. But we missed them for the first 10 years. And I just think unnecessarily, like, people, there's just so many resources and so many people who know what you're going through. And I just think it's so important to have that.
For sure.
So getting connected to the association, sorry.
Yeah,
is huge. I think just to, if you have questions or, you know, there's support groups and I think that's key.
And so you talked about your advice for people recently diagnosed. What advice would you have for caregivers?
Probably the same, because that's the other thing. The association is amazing at supporting my care partner and giving him resources he needs. And I know he's called the 24/7 hotline before when we've had struggles. And I just think that, again, having those resources and having people who know what you're going through, because it's very hard on caregivers.
This might become an ongoing key theme for us. We did colon cancer before this, and that's exactly what we heard in that episode as well. Like not exactly lack of resources. There are a lot of resources for everything. Just a lack of not connecting the patient at the right, or the person who's living with the disease at the right time with the right resources is what we were hearing back then as well.
So. It's the same, yeah. And yeah, I so think there, it's there so has important.
To, yeah, it is so important. Yeah.
So moving to the diagnoses and treatment and the current like standards of care, as they're called in the healthcare field, what would you like to see changed?
Ooh, that's got all day. No, that's not true. It's gotten a lot better. I mean, I think just really, I always feel like there's a little bit of lack of compassion, and I think some of that comes from not knowing. I think there's a lot of physicians out there who just don't know. A really good friend of mine who is an advocate at the association, her grandfather is one of those people who was diagnosed and they never told their family. And, you know, we've heard of lots of those stories. And sometimes the physician will say, well, there's nothing you can do anyways, which is so untrue. And it was even untrue prior to 2 years ago, prior to this kind of new wave of drugs. And I think kind of where we are now, that still was untrue back then. There's still plenty of things you can do. Being prepared, making decisions, you know, just being able to be mindful of why things are the way they are, is huge. And so I just think I'd love to see a little more compassion. And I know that's hard. I have a niece, Susan, who was born recently with Down syndrome, which makes her, the statistics are everywhere, but pretty highly likely that she will get some kind of Alzheimer's or dementia as she grows up. And she's at the hospital, been off and on lately. And her mom, who's my best friend, and I have talked a lot about, like, you know, good doctors don't always have the best bedside manners. And I think that I don't know why, when it relates to this, I hear a lot of stories like that. And I'd like us to do better in that field.
It's fascinating that what you're talking about really isn't innovation.
I know.
It's about care and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perhaps all I can think about is maybe because Alzheimer's kind of is doesn't, like, in people's mind maybe doesn't fall in that deadly category of, you know, the cancer or the heart mm-hmm. ailment or something. So there is less compassion. That's what probably I can think mm-hmm. of. Moving on, is there any innovation on the horizon that gives you hope?
Oh, yeah, so much. You know, the association says we're in an era of treatment, and we really are. We had gone a long time without any scientific hope. Or I think, like, for me, I've always had hope. I don't know how you can do it any different. I don't know how you would get up every day. I would struggle to get up every day if I didn't have hope, period. And yet I think we're just closer and closer to, you know, understanding it. I think that was a big thing for a long time is, you know, scientists and doctors just, we don't understand why it happens and what kinds of things, you know, can change the outcome of it. Like, you know, if you don't smoke, you won't get lung cancer. Not always true, but mm-hmm. if you understand what I'm yeah. saying, like, you know, it's not, I think the fact that we're getting closer and closer to understanding it is getting us closer and closer to prevention and treatment.
On that note, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know about you or the disease or anything about Alzheimer's in general?
Just that you're not alone. We have an amazing association nationwide, and just so many resources and a place to feel that hope.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Canada. Yeah. All the association and everyone can also reach out to Canada, Fierce Advocate of Alzheimer's, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Susan Perriott, CEO of the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota and North Dakota. She's the Chief Executive Officer, which she became in 2012, and became the Region 5 leader for the association in 2017, managing operations in Minnesota, North Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wisconsin.
Ooh-hoo.
At the association, Perriott has expanded care and support services, including programs focused on diversity and inclusivity, a cause close to mine and Rashmi's hearts. She has advanced public policy at the state and federal levels, with legislation for Alzheimer's research and support being passed every year in Minnesota and increased state funding in the North Dakota Dementia Care Services Program, a program that provides services and support across the state. For 2 years, the chapter hosted the largest walk to end Alzheimer's in the country, raising $1.7 million, and the event continues to be in the top five of walk to end Alzheimer's across the country. That's amazing.
It is.
Under Susan's leadership, the Minnesota and North Dakota chapter has achieved all strategic plan goals every year since 2013, and the chapter has doubled its funding. Before joining the Alzheimer's Association, she served as the executive director of the ALS Association, Minnesota and North Dakota, South Dakota chapter for 11 years, where she substantially grew its revenue, allowing the chapter to expand its services and service area to include North and South Dakota. Prior to her work with ALZ, she was the executive director of the Pearson Lakes Art Center in Okoboji, Iowa. Susan has been a proud member of the Rotary since 1999.
Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. That's really long. We'll have to cut that down.
That's amazing accomplishments, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time out of your busy CEO schedule to talk with us. Will you please tell us about your organization and the national organization?
Yes. The Alzheimer's Association, we are a nationwide organization, so we have chapters across all 50 states, and we are the largest voluntary health organization looking at Alzheimer's disease and all other forms of dementia. And I look at our organization as kind of that three-legged stool, where we have resources and support for people who are on this journey with dementia. We do advocacy work at the state and federal levels, and of course, we fund research.
You're clearly a skilled, knowledgeable woman who could do many things with your career. You could be in industry, you could work for a medical device company. Why are you focused on Alzheimer's?
I have loved being in nonprofits for more than 25 years. It gives you all those warm feels that we want out of our work. And it truly has given my life purpose. And I remember when my kids were really little and I would have to leave for events, they would always say, "Oh, Mom, you have to go." And I'd say, "You know what Mom does?" They're like, "Yeah, you help people that are really sick." I'm like, "Yep." And that made me feel so much better. Coming from ALS, it's a world where not many people have that disease, but it is very devastating. I loved that organization. It was fabulous. We did wonderful things. But coming to Alzheimer's, I thought, you know, if we really can find some treatments, some prevention methods, something to help these people, we literally will change the world. Because as you said earlier, there are 7 million people in the United States that have Alzheimer's disease, and that number is going to grow. So anything that we come up with, solutions, it's going to be transformative for all of us. And that is really exciting.
Yes, it is.
So when I was doing my own research, and I think many people come across this, it kind of feels like dementia and Alzheimer's are the same thing, which I believe they're not. Could you please like elaborate a little bit on the difference between the two?
Sure. That's a common question that people ask me. Dementia is the umbrella term for cognitive decline or cognitive changes. And then Alzheimer's is one form of dementia. So there's about 50 different forms of dementia that would be under that umbrella. So think about it. If I said I had cancer, you would say, what kind of cancer do you have? So if I say I have dementia, you might say, what form of dementia do you have? Alzheimer's, again, being the one that 60 to 70% of people, if they have dementia, they have Alzheimer's disease.
So, but is dementia, all disease relate to declining cognitive abilities?
Correct.
Okay.
One thing we learned in preparing for this podcast is that people with Alzheimer's prefer to be called people living with dementia, correct?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about any other ways of explaining this disease that is more respectful to people that have it?
I think one of those reasons is, you know, nobody wants to be a patient. And I think there's, I don't want to say pity, but we, you know, we feel bad for somebody that is has a disease. But people with Alzheimer's disease, especially like you look at Canada, a younger person, she's living with this disease. And we at the association want to help people live as well as they can on this journey and make their journey as easy as possible. So I don't think anybody normally wants to be defined just by their disease, but that they are still the person that they were and this is something that they have.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Can you please like elaborate some early indicators that should prod some people to get tested themselves? Like when is a good time? Like we were talking with Canada earlier and I forget, I literally forget so many things, but like when should I be worried enough to go to the doctor?
Yes, it is when you know, those issues become a problem and interfere with your daily life, the routines of your daily life. So as Canada was talking about, she couldn't remember how to wash her hair. That's something that you do just instinctively. You learned how to do that when you were, what, 3, 4, 5, and it's something you do every day. I know a person who, you know, worked his entire life with computers, and one day he went to the computer and couldn't figure out how to turn it on. I mean, that's something that he should remember how to do, and it really was interfering with his basic daily life. Yes, forgetting where the keys are or that you lost the keys, not a problem. You can retrace your steps. If you find them, that's great. It's when the keys are in your hand and you don't know what they're for. You know, so things like that, forgetting how to not being able to follow a recipe, something that we do all the time. There's a lot of times it shows up in our financials. You know, so writing checks maybe too often. We all maybe forget to pay a bill once in a while, but it's when you do it multiple times. You're mm-hmm. doing inappropriate things with money, say taking out large amounts of money out of your accounts, buying cars multiple times a month. We've heard of people doing that. That can be a real sign. I think one of the biggest signs is a personality change. Not everybody realizes that. So think about the person who's maybe really outgoing and friendly and loves to be social and around people, and all of a sudden they start to withdraw. They don't want to go out with people. Their mood completely changes. They're a completely different person. Often they are diagnosed with just depression, you know, midlife depression or something like that. But I think we need to dig deeper to see, is it something else? Because people, when they are not being able to respond what they think is appropriate, they will start withdrawing from situations and their whole personality can change.
If you were to coach somebody on what to tell their doctor about their memory issues, what words would you give them to bring this up to their primary care doctor?
I think the first thing is just being the strongest advocate for yourself, because yes, it happens. There's lots of reasons why stress, you know, our daily lives, by the time you're our age, my age at least, there's a lot of information up there. It's easy to forget things. So being that advocate for yourself, don't accepting the dismissive or, oh, it's nothing to worry about. Like, let's dig deeper. Can we do maybe just the initial little tests? There's smaller tests that they can start with to see if there's a problem, and then advance if there are things that show up that they are concerned about. Making sure you know your history and being honest about it. Nobody wants to do this. And I think one of the hardest things for people with Alzheimer's disease or that are having cognitive change is they think the doctor's going to bring it up and ask the questions in your mm-hmm. annual physical, and the doctor's waiting for you to say something about it. So that's where I would say always be that advocate for yourself. Express those concerns. Let's dig a little deeper and get those baselines, like Canada talked about. I think that's important. And some of the innovations that are coming through for Alzheimer's disease, one is a blood test. So think about when you are in having your annual physical and you get your blood work up, one of those biomarkers they might be checking for is the amyloid buildup in your brain. Now, again, just because it starts to build up doesn't mean you have Alzheimer's disease, but then it could be something that they would start watching and watch that baseline to determine when might you need medication, when you should be doing lifestyle changes, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Early screening, we're told, is really important in Alzheimer's. Why is it important?
Because you get to be involved in decisions about your life. Everybody wants to decide how they're going to grow old, what kind of care they want, what are things that they want to do. If you're never told that you have a disease, how do you plan for that? You need to be able to plan financially for this. What does that look like? Make sure that you have powers of attorney set up, or do you have other people on your bank accounts, you know, so you don't lose money. You become much more susceptible to scams just as an adult. Then add in there, if you have Alzheimer's disease, you're really susceptible to that. So I think being able to plan your future. But there are things that you can do. I think that's a big misconception, that there's nothing you can do for Alzheimer's disease right now. You know, you can make lifestyle changes right now to reduce your risk for the disease. And if you are already diagnosed, it can help still improve your cognition. So think about getting enough sleep. If you don't get enough sleep, your brain is super foggy. Make sure you get enough sleep. Exercise. Get out there and get that oxygen. That's good for your brain, too. Eat right. You know, stop smoking. Drink in moderation. You know, all those things that are going to actually help your brain and help your cognition. That can maintain your cognition for as long as possible and hopefully slow the decline of what's happening to you. Now, as drugs are becoming available, it's going to be important, because the drugs that are out there, the one drug that we have right now, it's for the early stages of the disease. So if you are really showing the dementia part of the disease and having real issues, it's not going to help you. In mm-hmm. fact, 2,000 people a day advance beyond being able to use these drugs. So we want to get people in the earliest stages, be able to slow down the decline of the disease and keep them in that early stage where they can continue to work, continue to drive, be part of their family, be part of the community, and create more memories. Isn't that what it's all about?
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Is there a standard age right now for early screening?
65. In your kind of your first Medicare visit is when they would start some of that screening. At age 65, it's 1 in 9 people are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And by age 85, it's 1 in 3. But there are younger people all the time that have that. So I think, you know, as we talk about heart disease and we are now, you know, looking at kids, what do we eat? How do we exercise? What are kind of those lifestyle things we can start as young children? It's the same for the brain. What's good for your heart is good for your brain. And I always say, you know, it's actually the brain is the computer that's running the whole body. So that's mm-hmm. like the most important organ that we should be watching our entire lives.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah.
The Alzheimer's Association funds a lot of research. What criteria does the national organization use to select projects to fund? Because I understand your chapter doesn't really fund research.
No, and you do not want me reading those research projects or applications or whatever they call them. We have an entire panel of scientists, not only on our staff, but then they gather neurologists from around the country that will read all the RFPs, the proposals. And we get hundreds of them and decide which ones are the best ones to fund. And what I love about our association is we really work hand in hand with NIH, National Institutes of Health, so we can see what they're doing and know where they're funding and what gaps there are, so that then our association can come in and fund those gaps. And then the next step would be, if something's really promising, give that to the drug companies that can scale it from there. So it's a pretty intense process with lots of really smart people who are on those committees.
Susan, can you talk a little bit about the latest innovations or the latest research that gives you a lot of hope? I know you mentioned the blood work.
Yes.
Yes.
That is really exciting to me because, again, we could diagnose really early, that we have our first treatments available. I have always had hope, just as Canada has had, but, you know, there is a part of your brain that sometimes is like, oh, my goodness, will I ever see anything? And I really look at this and look at my kids who are in their 20s and think they will never have to face this disease like the people that have it currently. I hope they never have to see their mom have this disease and face what they might, because there is such hope. And I can equate this to my father. My father has heart disease. He told me when I was a kid he was going to die when he was age 50 from a heart attack, because everybody in his family had heart attacks and died at age 50 or shortly thereafter. And literally at age 50, I'm waiting for him to drop dead. You know, like, come on, Dad, what's going to happen? Well, my dad's 84 now. He's lived through two heart attacks, had two angioplasties, you know, kind of quit smoking, you know, changed his diet, did some exercise. But that's how science advanced. Because if you think about 34 years ago, men died of heart attacks in their 50s and their 60s. That doesn't happen anymore, or not as frequently. We're not dying of cancer like we used to, because we know how to treat, we know how to prevent, we know how to help people once they have it. I see us going there with Alzheimer's disease. We are learning how to treat it. We are learning how to reduce our risk for it for prevention. I hope that someday we either don't ever get this disease or we learn to live with it as a chronic disease.
Amen.
Amen, yes. And congratulations to you and your family and your dad to making it to 84. Yeah.
If listeners wanted to track emerging research in Alzheimer's, how could they do that? Where could they go online?
Oh, my gosh. Go to ALZ.org. Come to our website, and there's a whole research section. You can read all the latest of things that are coming out there. We often have a lot of responses to science that's been released in other forms, like, say, in the Wall Street Journal or things like that, too, and like try to help people weed through some of those big articles that can be hard to understand.
And if one of our listeners needs the support of the Alzheimer's Association, how do they contact the Alzheimer's Association to get that support?
Yes. Again, go on our website, alz.org. And we also have a toll-free helpline number that's answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in 200 different languages. But we are there to answer the simplest question to the really complex questions. We can, you know, be that person that just listens. Sometimes somebody just needs that extra voice to hear them out, to see if they're doing things okay or they're having a really rough day. We can be there for that as well.
Well, today we're thankful for your voice and Canada's voice and Dr. Gogler's voice as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
To reach the Alzheimer's Association, you can dial 800-272-3900. And the website is alz.org.
And now we welcome our third guest for today, Dr. Gogler. Dr. Gogler is a distinguished McKnight University professor and Robert L. Kane Endowed Chair in Long-Term Care and Aging at the School of Public Health, University of Minnesota. His research focuses on long-term care for individuals with Alzheimer's and chronic conditions. His research explores family caregiving, community-based services, and implementation science in this field. An applied gerontologist with a long list of awards and publications under his belt, it's a pleasure to have him here with us today. Welcome, Dr. Gogler. Can we start today by understanding why are you so interested in this particular disease and caregiving?
No, thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure. Yeah, it's a long story in terms of why I'm so interested in this particular area. And it really starts back when I was a undergraduate student at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter. I was a psychology and history major at the time. And even though I loved both subjects, I didn't quite know what to do with either after I would have graduated from Gustavus. So one of the great things that the psychology program had offered students at the time was a internship opportunity, specifically an externship, where students could get connected with a organization over the summer before their senior year, and they could more or less immerse themselves in an area of interest. And the organization I was connected with was actually Catholic Charities of St. Paul. They have, and I believe they still have, a geriatric social work unit. And I was connected with a geriatric social worker on their team. And the very first thing we did is I accompanied the social worker on a visit, and it was a home visit to a woman who was caring for her husband living with Alzheimer's disease. And I saw firsthand what that was like for her and for him as well, the complexities, the challenges, the potential emotional strain that can occur in that situation. And it really resonated with me at the time. And I knew then that I wanted to focus on aging as part of my psychology major, and specifically with a focus on dementia care. And so when I was thinking of where to go for graduate schools, I was lucky enough to be accepted at Penn State University in their Department of Human Development and Family Studies. And my mentor there was a gentleman by the name of Steve Zaret, who was a pioneer in the space of dementia caregiving, mental health and aging, et cetera. Really one of the most honored gerontologists in our field and discipline. And I had the luck to work with him. And it really, my scientific focus grew from there with this focus on dementia caregiving. And it further crystallized when I did what was called a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Minnesota with Bob Kane, who was a professor. He held what was called at the time the Minnesota Long-Term Care Chair in Aging. Really, again, one of the most renowned geriatricians this country has ever known. He has a great expert in health services research, models of care for older people, et cetera. And then I also worked with his erstwhile partner and spouse, Rosalie Kane, who was also in the School of Public Health. And so they really instilled upon me, I would say, a more systems perspective in how do we better assist families caring for loved ones living with dementia. And that's really where I think the seeds of my passion in this space began.
Great. I'm really glad you're studying this area. I lost my stepmother to Alzheimer's just at the beginning of COVID. Between the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic, nearly every patient indication is being researched. What areas of Alzheimer's treatment research in Minnesota are you following, and what gives you the most hope?
I think what gives me the most hope, it's interesting. I mean, it seems like it's an easy answer. It should be an easy answer. And it's not, in part because this past 18 months have actually shown us some really exciting but also potentially challenging breakthroughs in how we understand Alzheimer's disease. There really, I think, are three areas that I'm focusing on, or at least watching closely. The first is soon, I think it will be widely available, will be a blood test to ascertain whether we have amyloid plaque formation in our brains. And forgive me if I don't know the medical specificity of this. I am not a pathologist or neurologist, but nonetheless, from my understanding, this should be available fairly soon. It's exciting at one level in that it could offer the opportunities to identify people who may be at heightened risks for developing the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease before they actually show those symptoms. And so it may have great promise, but it also is a challenge as well in that how are we going to convey this information to potential patients? Are therapies, both pharmaceutical, infusion-based therapies, which is another new development, or non-pharmacological therapies available to connect people with after, say, they obtain this blood test or blood screen? But nonetheless, it's a major breakthrough in Alzheimer's disease. The second also is the advent of new therapeutics for Alzheimer's disease that now do have FDA approval, that certainly seem to have effects or efficacy in reducing the accumulation of amyloid plaque in the brain. But again, that also comes with, I would argue, important challenges. Even though reducing amyloid plaque formation in the brain is thought to be an important aspect of managing Alzheimer's disease, it's not a simple one-to-one correlation, amyloid plaque formation and then the functional, behavioral, cognitive symptoms of Alzheimer's disease necessarily. Second is the cost of these therapeutics. On average, they will cost roughly $20,000 to $25,000. Right now, Medicare will cover that to a point, But again, for those on Medicare Advantage plans or other types of insurance arrangements, what does that really mean from a cost standpoint? And there are also potential adverse effects of these therapeutics. For example, abnormalities that can occur in the brain in very serious circumstances, hemorrhages in the brain. And again, the trials that actually tested these therapeutics were only done over a year and a half. We don't know what long-term use of these therapeutics will mean. Now, again, there's some evidence that long-term benefits of these therapeutics can occur with short-term use, which would be incredibly exciting and incredibly important, not only from a quality of life standpoint for people taking these therapeutics, but also potentially from a cost-effectiveness one as well. But again, I think more evidence needs to emerge on that. Now, the third breakthrough that I'm watching very closely, and I don't think has gotten the attention that it should, although those of us in the dementia care space are very excited with this, is what is going to be called the GUIDE model. The GUIDE is an acronym. I don't remember what it stands for. My apologies. Many of us in academia are awash in acronyms, so I can't always remember what they stand for. But essentially what the GUIDE model is and why it's so important is it is a new way to incentivize multidisciplinary collaborative dementia care. Essentially, healthcare providers applied and will launch this GUIDE model beginning in July. And what the GUIDE model essentially is it offers care navigation to people living with dementia. I mean, when you think about some of the challenges people living with dementia and families have, it's often navigating a healthcare system that is very unforgiving to older people living with chronic conditions, particularly older people living with dementia. And the point of the GUIDE model is it more or less assembles a team along with a care navigator to provide this ongoing support to not only the person living with dementia, but also a care partner as well. This is what makes this policy and approach unique in that in order to deliver the GUIDE model, if a care partner is available, that care partner must be included in care planning and also must be provided respite and relief services. So it also features this integration with community-based services and supports too, which heretofore haven't always been as readily available to many people who say obtain or receive a diagnosis of dementia and may not necessarily know what to do next and may not receive that guidance from a healthcare provider as to what to do next. That is certainly a major gap, and this is a gap that potentially the GUIDE model can fill.
Thank you so much. My next question actually was on care innovation. Mm-hmm. You briefly already touched upon it. Is there anything else you think other than the GUIDE model that is out there that gives you hope about the care innovation?
Yeah, I think there are many innovations that at this point have actually obtained a fair amount of research support suggesting their potential benefits. I'm hedging my bets a little bit here. I mean, a dyed-in-the-wool scientist may argue that, well, you know, in certain randomized controlled trials and meta-analyses, they haven't necessarily shown effectiveness. But that being said, from a more practical perspective, from an implementation perspective, I would argue, in fact, there are a number of innovations that are available that it's less about we need to discover new innovations, more about we need to scale them and implement them so they can benefit mm-hmm. the most people possible. I mean, among some of the exciting innovations that, again, have received attention for, in some cases, decades, if not many years, are models like the greenhouse model, which are small residential care settings that very much emphasize environment and emphasize home-like environments and move far beyond what is traditionally a fairly hospital, medically oriented nursing home model. I mean, that's one innovation, for example. A second innovation is what's called the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, or PACE. And why PACE is so exciting is it is a model that really effectively integrates both healthcare services and community-based services under one umbrella. It was first developed in the late 1970s, actually in San Francisco, at a program called ONLOK, O-N-L-O-K, that actually served Chinese and Italian immigrants. So it was very culturally oriented, but again, based around what we know are ideal geriatric care principles, integration of chronic disease support along with healthcare support and community-based and social support. Unfortunately, Minnesota does not offer PACE programs. However, there's a task force that has been assembled to begin to do studies to determine whether PACE is viable to actually deliver here in the state of Minnesota. There are other innovations, too, that are out there. These are, in addition to GUIDE, these are some that just jump to the top of my mind. But again, I think the main point here is I certainly believe we are at the point in gerontological and geriatric science where it's less about having to necessarily develop new innovations and more about taking the innovations we know show a lot of promise and scaling and implementing them, which is a whole different issue. But nonetheless, I think that's where we're at.
So if you could wave a magic wand to drive some of this change more quickly, what do you have a couple things off the top of your mind that you'd like to see move quickly?
Well, I don't know. Moving quickly is probably being ambitious, but I mean, certainly if one looks at the healthcare system as a whole, how these innovations could be supported would be within healthcare systems that value outcome and are incentivized for outcome versus incentivized for service delivery. Often, geriatrics is a good example. We know geriatrics care that's done well results in very positive outcomes for older people. Reduced healthcare utilization, improved quality of life, you know, ability to stay at home longer. We just did a meta-analysis that actually showed this vis-a-vis inpatient geriatric units, that they are actually linked to delayed nursing home admission. But when one looks at how services are incentivized within healthcare, geriatrics is often a programmatic approach that doesn't align itself with a fee-for-service model. I mean, what geriatrics requires is multidisciplinary teams. It requires time, ongoing engagement, navigation to really help, and planning to help often very ill or individuals with multiple chronic conditions, helping them navigate a number of different needs. And a multidisciplinary geriatrics team can do that. However, it's not really care that's incentivized in our current system. I mean, in terms of waving a wand, that would be one thing. You know, a second thing in terms of maybe there will be potential for this or not, I don't know. I hope so. But right now, again, the Minnesota legislature convened what is called the Minnesota Legislative Task Force on Aging. The Center for Healthy Aging and Innovation, which I direct at the University of Minnesota, actually has a seat on the task force, along with four legislators and several other representatives of different entities of Minnesota state government. And we are tasked with delivering a report. Basically, the goal of the task force is to re-envision aging services in terms of how they're delivered, how they're organized to better meet the needs of older Minnesotans. And one point I emphasized very strongly at the very beginning of this task force, I've sat on, if not task forces, many, many initiatives where, you know, white papers were developed or this report, this group of recommendations, et cetera, and they end up sitting on the shelf. There's never a plan of, okay, we have these recommendations. How are we going to track success? Are these recommendations going to be implemented? Have we developed dashboards to ensure that we do achieve the recommendations that will be provided in this legislative task force report or something else? And I think if we take that perspective, and again, it very much is aligned with what I mentioned earlier about the need to scale and implement innovations we already know. When we make these recommendations is that we put a very strong plan in place to evaluate and implement the recommendations. So again, they can reach everybody in the state that could benefit from them, whether it's in the Twin Cities area, whether it's in the many, many counties that perhaps are more rural in the state. In the end, that's what I would love to see, and I hope we see that, or at least move in that direction.
Can you think of anything that our listeners or that Rashmi and I could do to help ensure that some of these recommendations actually make it to society?
Well, I think the legislative task force is open to all public commentary. People can actually attend the task force meetings and can provide commentary. We actually did that this past week, and it was actually very enlightening to hear from the public. There's also an opportunity to email comments and such. And I think once this task force is again delivered in January, it's a time for again, people who are grappling with this themselves, maybe caring for a loved one, maybe our healthcare professional themselves, if you agree with the recommendations and feel passionate about it, take it to your legislator and say, this is what we need to age well in Minnesota. What are you doing about it? And I am confident that the recommendations we're going to come up with will, if implemented, help people age better.
One question I have, there is a stat that I mentioned in the beginning, is Alzheimer's is one of those diseases where it just doesn't impact the person who has dementia or Alzheimer's, right? It impacts the family and the caregivers. Is there any advice particularly to that group who's taking care of patients with dementia or Alzheimer's, yeah. And what would you like to tell them?
I mean, I think the first thing to really emphasize strongly, and I think many families don't realize this, particularly at the beginning of this journey, is you're not alone. There are many, many people who either are living with dementia in Minnesota or are caring for someone living with dementia in Minnesota. Roughly, the numbers now in terms of those caring for someone living with dementia are around close to 100,000. I think, in the state. So again, it is a prevalent issue. I think the first thing that somebody could do is to contact, and you heard from Sue Perriott earlier, is to contact the local Alzheimer's Association chapter. There's a 1-800 number that's available that people can call, where that will connect you with your local Alzheimer's chapter. And in the case of Minnesota, it's the Minnesota North Dakota Alzheimer's chapter, where you can find out about support groups, programs, services, et cetera, within your community. And that would be the first thing I would recommend. The second thing I would recommend is also to call what's called the Senior Linkage Line. And what the Senior Linkage Line is that connects people to your local area agency on aging. We have a team, and we also have more or less a library of resources and programs that we can, at the very least, connect people to. And to contact us, the best way would be to contact my research team, which is called the Families and Long-Term Care Projects. That's FLTC@umn.edu. And that's the easiest way to reach out to us. And again, we can help with that too.
We'll have that email address in the show notes for the podcast.
Oh, great. You know, another thing I'll mention too is one thing I've noticed is often when people attend my talks, they might not know about these programs and services, and they can get linked up with them. And again, there are a lot of local services and programs out there that even I don't know about, but are important to shine a spotlight on for communities. So they know they're there, and they know, again, they can receive help and support and realize they're not alone. You know, it's going to take me a while to finish the entire state. There are 87 counties, and I think I've hit 23 at this point, so I got a ways to go. But again, if someone wants me to come out to their county and I haven't visited it yet, they can reach me at that email address, fltc@umn.edu, and we'll put you on the calendar.
So, that's amazing. Yeah. Thank you. And you have a big event coming up on June 1st. Will you tell us a little bit about your event?
So yes, June 1st, it's the Caring for People with Memory Loss Conference. This is going to be our 17th. Is this our 17th? Yeah, I think it's our 17th year doing this now. We started this in 2008. This is a free conference, and it's really, this is not a scientific conference. This is a conference that provides tools, education, and resources to people living with dementia and those who care for them, either whether they're families, neighbors, friends, or healthcare professionals. Again, it's free to attend. We offer a hybrid format. So if people want to join via Zoom, they can watch the whole day, or they can come in person, and we offer free food as well. For healthcare professionals, we do offer continuing education credits for a pretty reasonable price. It's $50 to get around 7 hours. So I think that's pretty reasonable. And we offer that for multiple disciplines. And what we try to do is we try to be very responsive each year to what attendees want to hear about. And so we'll have 4 presentations throughout the day. This year, the presentations are going to focus on resilience in the context of living with dementia or caring for someone living with dementia. Again, very important concept and important to think about. How can we build our resilience? Because we know and understand it's challenging. We're going to talk about communication in the context of dementia. Again, an ongoing need, I think, for many people who are caring for loved ones living with dementia. We'll also have a spotlight on Black male caregivers. We actually have an expert from George Washington University who'll be joining via Zoom, but he'll be giving that presentation. He's an expert in that particular area. It'll be very exciting to hear from him as well. So, and then finally, we're going to have Sarah Barcell also. Sarah Barcell is, actually, she just won a big award from the AARP for, I think it's an innovation award. She is one of the foremost community activists in aging and dementia specifically. And some of her work actually focused on making MSP Airport dementia friendly based on some of the models that have taken root in Europe and then also Australia as well. What can we do to make airport and travel more dementia friendly. I think for those of us caring for people living with dementia, that is a real challenge. Very. The stimulation and the noise and everything in the airport. What can be done to make it easier? And Sarah has championed that work, and we're going to hear about from her too. And then the last thing I'll say about the conference and why I really encourage people to come if they're just starting or need more information is we're going to have around 15 exhibitors there. We'll have a senior lawyer there. We'll have the Alzheimer's Association. We'll have the Caregiver Connection, which is linked in with the Area Agencies on Aging. There'll be tons of resources and information on caregiving support and programs. So it's a great way to get connected with others and then also get information to help you with your journey. So.
And did I miss it? Is it at the University of Minnesota?
Yes, it's at the University of Minnesota at McNamara Alumni Center.
Okay.
We do have a website for the conference. It's z.umn.edu/memory-loss-conference. That's all one word. So
we'll have that in our show notes as well.
Good.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Joseph Gogler. We're honored that you shared so much great information with us.
Thank you. Yes, this is really helpful indeed.
Great. Well, thanks for having me again. It was a real pleasure.
My biggest takeaway from today is how important it is to advocate for yourself. If you think something might be wrong, go to your doctor and advocate for yourself. Tell them, I think I have this issue. I really need you to listen to me. What tests can I take to either rule it in or rule it out?
That's a good one, Mary. I think my biggest takeaway for today is I really felt it when Canada said how important compassion is. So I think not just for Alzheimer's alone, but for any disease, for the doctors to have that extra training. You never know what the patient or where the patient is coming from, right? To have that compassion in whatever you are dealing with is so important. So that's my big key takeaway for today.
Our next episode will be launching at the end of May, and that will be all about mental health and addictions. Rashmi setting up those speakers right now.
Yes, next episode coming soon in May. With that, like always, if you're interested to partner with us, please feel free to reach out at rashmi@healthcare.mn and be a part as a sponsor or be a part as somebody getting featured on one of these episodes. And we would love to collaborate with the community looking for partnerships. And we'll see you next time in May. Till then, be well, be strong, keep innovating.